Yes, Your Honor. Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is John Shepard. I'm appearing here today on behalf of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, where I serve as the Director of Legal Policy in the Office of General Counsel. We'd like 2 minutes to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, please, Your Honor.
All right, thank you.
Everyone agrees that both cases before the court today are not justiciable. Both decisions concern the Commission's authority over a filed rate in the event that a party seeks to reject a Commission jurisdictional power purchase agreement in bankruptcy. But PG&E has never alleged that it wished to reject any of those power purchase agreements, and it is now one confirmation of and made effective a reorganization plan that voluntarily assumes, not rejects, all of its PPAs. Any dispute that may ever have existed, and of course is something the Commission has always disputed, is now...
So how would you respond to PG&E's argument that FERC's orders forced the company to assume the contracts?
I believe that they've described it as casting a pall over their decision or somehow burdening the process. And, Your Honor, we didn't think that there was any merit to that suggestion, one of several that tried to escape from a straightforward application of Bancorp. The first problem with that argument, Your Honor, is a sort of a theoretical one. It is always going to the argument is overbroad because it is always going to be the case that someone who is trying to overturn a decision is burdened by it, and there's no other way to distinguish that situation here from any other case. If there were no bankruptcy court order, they would still be finding themselves burdened to the extent they felt that were true by the FERC order. And so I think that any step in that direction would begin to destroy the rule. The second problem is really factual, and that is that the Commission's orders, in particular the rehearing order, very expressly disclaims any jurisdiction over the rejection process. We merely explain that to the extent that PG&E does decide to reject, that if they also wish to change their filed rate, they're also going to have to come to FERC to complete that process. I'd also argue that PG&E's claim to have been somehow cowed by the Commission's orders is really belied by its conduct. Day one of the bankruptcy proceeding, they began by seeking and obtaining an order from the bankruptcy court that directed the Commission not to issue any orders that might in any way constrain what the bankruptcy court might do with regard to rejection in the event rejection was ever sought. And of course, it was not.
Counsel, why did FERC issue that order? Didn't it seem premature if PG&E hasn't said that they were going to reject any PPA? Why did FERC issue that order in the first place?
And it's not premature at the time that the first order was issued, nor on rehearing either, Your Honor. First, to step back for a moment, it is agencies, unlike courts, are not bound by the same rules with regard to standing. Administrative standing is looser. Indeed, I would argue that one of the critical functions that agencies perform as distinct from courts is the ability to provide advanced guidance that removes the need to have a conflict. And that's exactly what happened here. We had emergency petitions filed by, we ended up only issuing two of the orders because several people sought guidance on this subject. And after we got the first two emergency petitions, we just dismissed the other inbound ones and said, listen, we've already spoken, you can stop asking. So clearly there was a great deal of concern throughout the industry when a major national utility says it wants to reject $42 billion worth of contracts. You can understand why for them it was really quite an important thing to get an answer from the Commission, and so we provided that answer. It was very
counsel. If the agency is, as you say, and I think you're right, is differently situated than courts, and then I would think that would also cut against the agency's argument to try to kind of have it treated like a court in having in the Bancorp / Munsingware sort of analysis. If the agency, as you say, can kind of reach out there, one might say prematurely, or, you know, but that would be a pejorative way to put it. I guess you could say it in a positive way. Then maybe that would weigh in favor, since Bancorp involved, if I recall correctly, involved a court decision, right? Maybe that would mean that Bancorp should be modified a little bit if it's an agency.
Your Honor, I think this general appeal to equity is mistaken, this argument that PG&E makes, and here's why. The First, we have a straightforward rule, and the Supreme Court's decision does not distinguish between agencies or courts for purposes of the application of the rule. This court has not done that either, and I can indicate Pacific Tovo, for example, is one of the precedents that squarely confronts the application of this in the context of an agency decision rather than merely a court decision. So I believe this court's really already spoken to the idea that you look at both of those the same way. But it is very important to understand that Bancorp embraces the idea that precedent is important and you don't unsettle it unless you have a good reason to. But I don't think that it's necessary.
Right, but it's exactly on that point that I think that what I'm asking about, precedent that comes through a court system has already been sort of gone through the adversarial process and you know, courts are bound by, they don't decide moot questions. They have rightness issues and such. But I think you were just saying that an agency's slightly different. So an agency can kind of reach out there ahead. So you think that might militate a little bit differently for these considerations.
No, Your Honor, I don't. And if I could give some other reasons why I think that setting aside FERC's order here, in addition to I don't believe being permitted under Bancorp, but there are other reasons why it would be a bad idea to extend it this particular set of orders.
Well, so first, why do you want this arrow in your quiver? Why does FERC want to hold on to these? If I want to understand my decision, I always like to understand what people want to do with it. So why is this so important to you?
Your Honor, I'm happy to answer that question after first making this brief note. Under Bancorp, it is not our burden to explain why our decision needs to be retained, but instead the petitioner's burden to explain why it's entitled to the extraordinary remedy of vacature in a situation where they have destroyed their own right to review through a voluntary act, or actually a voluntary series of acts constantly ratified since the outset of this position. But why is this particular set of orders important? Because these are especially important orders. These are the Commission's most authoritative pronouncement on the relationship between bankruptcy courts and the Commission, where our previous encounters with this were a long time ago in the context of the merit proceeding, and much has changed. So this is our authoritative pronouncement about how we expect to interact with the courts. It makes important statements about what we expect people to not do, which is ask us to assert jurisdiction over the rejection process, for example. It deals with a great number of prior precedents and explains their role in how we approach matters in the FPA. Moreover, these orders have served as the launching pad. They're the foundational orders from which other orders have since issued. In particular, our most recent declaratory order called ETC Tiger, which applies the same concepts dealt with in this order in the NGA setting.
Can I ask you about that, counsel? Yeah, I was aware of that. And so why do you need this order? I mean, you have just because this, if this was vacated, you'd still have ETC.
We would still have ETC, but we would also need to explain why the foundational orders upon which those orders are based have been vacated. Or should we really be put to the burden of having to re-explain every time someone wants to cite our NGA orders or any other orders we might issue?
Typically, a Munsingware vacature is, I don't know why you have to explain it. It's just because the issue became moot. And I understand your argument as well, but this is differently situated. But that you would have to explain that. I mean, it's not like, not like the court would say you're wrong. It would just say they've vacated or vacated.
Well, again, Your Honor, again, return to the center of gravity on this, which is that I really don't think it's the Commission's task to have to explain why it wants to keep it. I think that we have good reasons for why we want to keep it, and I've still got one more to add there. But again, the burden here is clearly on PG&E to explain.
Well, the bankruptcy court was very hostile towards FERC. I mean, in my review of that, if we had to decide it, and was basically saying, FERC, go away. You don't belong here. That's a terrible
description of the bankruptcy courts.
I mean, really just did not want to see your face. Do not darken my door. You are not welcome here. And so that would have been part of what we would have had to decide, you know, whether exactly you had a right to be there and, you know, whether the bankruptcy court was right about that. But we're not going to decide that at this point. Is part of your reason that you don't want bankruptcy courts to say go away?
I think we would prefer to avoid injunctions from bankruptcy courts wherever we can possibly do that. I think Your Honor was probably aware that we've already had to litigate that question once in the Sixth Circuit, and that decision became final on Monday when the deadline for certiorari passed. So yes,
and the result of that was
the result of the
Sixth Circuit.
The Sixth Circuit's decision attempted to reconcile the viewpoint that the Fifth Circuit took in an older case called Merritt. They vacated and remanded the bankruptcy court's injunction against FERC in that case, which presented a different fact pattern than the one here, because there, FERC never got the opportunity to issue an order because that company went to the bankruptcy court first and obtained an order preventing us from doing anything initially.
Well, let me talk a little bit about why doesn't the state wildfire fund's June 20th deadline constitute exceptional circumstance warranting vacatur of the FERC orders? Because obviously, PG&E surprisingly doesn't emphasize that as much as I would have if I were in their position, but it was talked about earlier as. There's no doubt. I mean, people that live in California, we're all aware of the problems that have occurred and Paradise getting completely wiped out and all of the complaints against PG&E and all of that. And $21 billion were at stake. And PG&E's got lawsuits and problems all up the wazoo. So and apparently the governor's pushing them. And if they didn't agree to honor the contracts, and if they didn't get this over and get out of bankruptcy, they leave $21 billion on the table. So why isn't that kind of an extraordinary thing that isn't of their making?
Well, the wildfires were an unusual event. The wildfire fund was an unusual event. All of these things were unusual events, but none of them bear on the question here. What makes this case moot is nothing to do with their timing of the wildfire fund or anything else. That business decision.
Excuse me one second to the clerk. I can't see the clock anymore. Did you get rid of the clock?
I'm 1 minute and 49 seconds over, Your Honor.
Okay, but I lost the clock by the clerk. I just kind of want to know is.
It should still be there, Judge.
Okay. Yeah, we lost the clock. Now I can't see. All right. Is there a way? Now I don't see Mr. Shepard. Oh, yeah, I guess.
I think she's on. I think. Judge
okay. Callum now I see it. Okay. That's good. Okay.
Your
that's
Honor,
good.
All, okay. All of the things that you mentioned with regard to external things that might have driven PG&E's bankruptcy decisions, including the attempt to reorganize in the first place, are all important to PG&E's considerations, but they have nothing to do with the fight in this case. What makes this case moot was not the expiration of time. This is not a deadline situation. There could have been a wildlife fund or no wildlife fund. What made this case moot, indeed, what made this case never ripe, was the fact that PG&E never, ever suggested or attempted to reject one of their contracts. That was a decision.
Well, let me ask you this, because this is the response to one thing PG&E is claiming against you. If FERC failed to protect itself by, for example, declining to pursue a stay of the bankruptcy proceedings, as PG&E asserts, how does that play into this?
That's their second and I think a rather specious claim. They attempt to support some need to not set aside the bankruptcy court order, which seems to be kind of a fig leaf argument. There is no reason that the commission had any interest in trying to stay the reemergence of a major national utility from bankruptcy in order for it to resume its regular course of business. There was no reason, certainly, for us to do anything which would cause them to lose access to the wildfire fund. And I can't think that they would seriously contend that they would have preferred that we attempt to stay the bankruptcy court's orders in order to endanger their access to either of those things. That can't possibly be right as in terms of the way that the burdens are allocated here. Our only interest in this case ever has been to make the following assertion. Do whatever you wish in bankruptcy via rejection or assumption of contracts, but in the event that you are going to reject a contract in bankruptcy court, that court has no power to actually change the filed rate. You must come here and do that. That is the only interest we've ever been interested in vindicating, and that interest is in no way implicated by the wildfire fund or any of the other considerations that drove the company to bankruptcy.
Counsel, the one question I have is, it seems that according to our precedent, we hold the actions of mooting a case against the party that mooted the case only if their actions were related to dependency of the appeal. And that's from Rixby and Dilley. What were the actions? The actions that seemed to moot this case had nothing to do with this appeal, in my view.
Your Honor, I don't think that's a correct reading of the law in the post Bancorp world. I think Bancorp eliminates the idea, as Dilley mentions, that a nefarious motive is a requirement. It can certainly, if a party acts with a deliberately nefarious motive, they're trying to destroy the mootness. If that's their intent, well, of course that can be an aggravating factor, but it is not, Your Honor, a required factor. And if you like, I can quote language from Dilley to that effect, because they walk through Bancorp on this very point and say vacatur is not appropriate where an appeal is mooted, even if the appellant did not intend to hinder appellate review. I mean, it's there in Dilley already. And again, I think that's a good idea. If you look if you want the rule to work, because you don't have to do an inquiry. Sometimes there's been a need for an inquiry. Dilley presented that situation because that was the contention. But I don't think it after Bancorp that one can seriously argue it's required. It can definitely pour gasoline in the fire.
Do either of my colleagues have any additional questions? Okay, so I'm going to give you, we've taken you significantly over, but we had questions, so that's just fine. I'm going to give you 2 minutes for rebuttal then.
All right. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
May it please the court.
Good morning.
I'm John Estes. I represent NextEra in this case and stand here in front of a number of allied parties on our briefs. We were petitioners with FERC on appeal of the bankruptcy case. We were interveners supporting FERC in the agency case. I would suggest you ask the question why PG&E cares what happens to these decisions. And the answer, I think, is they don't. The only reason they would care is if they're in bankruptcy, which they're not, or they were headed back in soon, which I am quite sure we are not going to hear today. We care for a very concrete reason. We started the FERC case because we were concerned that PG&E was going to reject contracts that were valuable to us and to the state of California. We prevailed, but that order was one of general applicability. Now the PG&E risk has faded into the background. As PG&E itself says in its brief at pages 4 and 5, it's speculative to imagine PG&E will care again about whether it can accept or reject a contract in bankruptcy. We care because the 34 companies on the signature block of our brief have within them, by the way, subsidiaries that hold hundreds of contracts. NextEra itself has hundreds of subsidiaries that are within this case. So we're talking about a broad swath of commerce involving the power industry. And as Mr. Shepard said, this goes into the gas industry too. You're talking about between those two industries, something like 8% of the gross national product of the United States of America. We want the ability to preserve what Congress gave FERC in terms of its authority under the Power Act and the Gas Act, which is the ability to look at whether regulatory obligations need to be altered in the event a contract is rejected. It is, I would submit to you, highly likely that one of the companies here before you today is going to face that problem. In fact, I would submit to you, it's more likely that PG&E will be on our side of the street rather than its side of the street it was on previously, just as it was in the wake of its earlier bankruptcy when it opposed Calpine's bankrupt rejection arguments on the same grounds. The Calpine was making the same arguments that PG&E made previously. We care because we think FERC's regulatory obligation framework protects the public interest and is important to the health and efficiency of the power industry and the gas industry nationwide. FERC's decision applies nationwide. It's not limited to PG&E. We stand here, we started our efforts in this case to deal with PG&E's rejection. We now stand here to defend the ramparts of Bancorp and this court's decision in Rixby, which, by the way, presages Bancorp, and this court's decision in Dilley, which say if you engineer mootness, if you kill off your own appeal, in this case of the FERC case, you don't get vacature. If you prevail below and you kill off your opponent's appeal, which is what happened to us in the bankruptcy case, vacature follows. It's automatic. What PG&E wants is for you to get one of those cases wrong under the Supreme Court's guidance, actually rulings and your rulings. They want you to either get the wrong answer in the FERC case, vacate it when that ground does not lie under prevailing precedent for good reasons, or they want you to to leave the bankruptcy case intact. They want you to commit error, reversible error, in one of these cases under the ground of equity. It's just fair. But PG&E doesn't care what happens here. We care. And their version of equity contradicts what Justice Scalia said in Bancorp, which is the prime consideration in figuring out what is equitable, what is fair, what is just, is where did mootness come from? Where did it come from? Here, PG&E is the prime mover of mootness. They should not.
But counsel, you mentioned that Bancorp says that we hold it against them when mootness results from the unilateral action of the party prevailed below. How did PG&E prevail below in the FERC?
Oh, they didn't. If that's what I said, Your Honor, I apologize. I misspoke.
That's what Bancorp says. I mean, you quoted it correctly, but I just don't understand how PG&E prevailed below.
Well, I think it stands for the general proposition that you look at where at who the engineer of mootness is. And the question becomes, what's the geometry of the case? In the first incarnation of all of this, the prevailing party would seek to, would there would be mootness caused by the prevailing party. And the question would be, well, what do we do? And the answer is the underlying decision is mooted. But what this court in Dilley and Ringsby confirmed is that if you have the converse, which we have in the FERC case, where...
Mr. Estes, all of this is sort of built on the idea that you're talking about. You said you have a powerful argument that, you know, the parties don't really care so much about this, or at least shouldn't. It seems like PG&E cares. They're here, but we'll hear from them in a second. But let's say you're right; they don't really care, but we care. These third party entities. I mean, that's exactly the reason. You're right. That's exactly the reason why sometimes the orders are left in place. But there's also, I mean, the general Munsingwear rule is you want to get rid of these decisions because you want to get rid of decisions precisely because people might care about them, but they won't have actually been sort of fully vetted, right? Fully vetted, ruled on by a court, et cetera. I mean, that's the general Munsingwear rule. It seems to me that here, you know, everybody's trying to argue about, trying to say this is like Bancorp and stuff, but what makes this different in one sense is this is not a lower court decision that was just, that was an independent party deciding an issue, and so now you should benefit from that. This was FERC deciding its own jurisdiction, right? And having had no court actually rule on that, having that now be the law that you all can rely on, it seems to me that the general concept behind Munsingwear, if no court has addressed it, all it's been is FERC sort of shockingly saying, hey, we have jurisdiction, right? It's a very self-interested decision. Like, why should we allow all these third parties to benefit from that when no court has been able to rule on it? I've been able to, like, actually have an independent party look at it.
Well, Your Honor, as someone who litigates in the courts of appeals, you know, after FERC cases on both sides, sometimes as a petitioner and sometimes as a supporting intervener, I understand and agree with the notion that a reviewing court needs to sometimes pass on what an agency says. But in this situation, because of the fabric of administrative law, if FERC's decision, which we obtain in the NextEra case, were to be applied to pick someone different who's in bankruptcy 2 years from now, they get to challenge FERC's decision as applied to them. It's not like the ship sailed 3 years ago and they can't do anything about it. This is just a prior agency ruling.
FERC was just telling us that they've taken this decision and already applied it in ETC, and I didn't quite understand why it's a big deal if this decision goes away, but they seem to have thought so. So I don't know if that's, you know, your idea that, you know, it'll be a brand new day when the next decision, and they won't rely on it. No, they will too. That's why they want to keep it. That's why you want to keep it.
Well, no, Your Honor, I actually think that's not.
Well, but FERC can still take the same view. They just don't have the imprimatur of a court at that point. If we vacate, it's not saying FERC was wrong, is it? It's just not saying FERC was right.
Well, but if you decline to vacate, you're not saying anything on the merits either, Your Honor. And if I might go back.
I don't think that you're not, people don't try to hold on to something that tight if it's not going to be used in a way to say that we're right.
Well, Your Honor, let me answer your question and Judge Van Dyke's question. In the ETC case, ETC gets to argue that FERC's relying on precedent. It's wrong, but let's talk about what the rule is here. There's no bootstrapping where in an agency context, the FERC may have a prior precedent, but that doesn't matter when it comes to the next case. FERC, by the way, can reverse its view on precedent. And if you step back for a moment, I guess what I would say is that PG&E wants an outcome that's never appeared before in reported decisions. They want to achieve vacature of an order, an agency order here, it's true, in a context where they engineered mootness. They can't point to any case where that's happened, nor can they point why they care about whether the case...
What business would walk away from $21 billion fund to help them deal with all their legal issues and problems? I mean, PG&E is, you know, probably... With consumers, PG&E isn't one of the most popular people in the state of California.
Your Honor, Mr. Shepard was entirely correct. They could have rejected the contracts. We're glad they didn't. We're very glad they didn't. But one reason we supported Expedition from the get-go, because we were concerned that $21 billion carrot, which does apply to all the utilities in California, was going to have PG&E race forward. We were not going to be able to overturn the bankruptcy court's decision, and the ship was going to sail before we got our day in court. As it happened, happily, PG&E assumed the contracts, but that was their choice. They engineered their own mootness. The fact that they decided to do that on the way to getting a share of the $21 billion is just sort of part of the landscape. And there's always going to be collateral considerations that drive a commercial party's actions in a mootness context. Who knows why the bankruptcy settlement in Bancorp happened? It's just natural that you'll have things influencing the course of action. I would submit to you, Your Honor, that the best place to look for your reaction to the equities here is Judge Randolph's inimitable decision in the Northern California Power Authority case in the D.C. Circuit in 2006. Because there he looked at PG&E having just emerged from their first romp through bankruptcy, trying to oppose vacature of a NRC decision in the wake of the bankruptcy after a settlement made the case moot. And the other side of the NRC case said, wait a second, we didn't have anything to do with that. That decision should stand, should be vacated because we lost below. And Judge Randolph said about PG&E's arguments, nonsense. One might as well say, the victim caused the robbery by failing to put up enough resistance. What were we supposed to do? They assumed the contracts, try and throw sand in the gears of victory and delay their emergence from bankruptcy?
I think those are all good points that we wanted to hear. Let me find out if we're obviously over, but I want to make sure if my colleagues have additional questions, there's an opportunity for that.
I'm good. Thank you.
Thank you so much. All right, well, now we'll move to PG&E, and I can assure you, already you've seen that my time limits have gone out the window, so we'll make sure that we have all our questions answered relative to your position as well.
Thank you, Your Honor. Elaine Goldenberg for PG&E, and I'd like to reserve 4 minutes of my time for rebuttal. The FERC order here should be vacated under the usual presumption of vacature in the event of mootness. PG&E is not at fault or to blame for mootness here because there was no voluntary forfeiture of PG&E's appeal rights. And the FERC orders, which this court may well have found unlawful had the court gotten to the merits, as both the Fifth and the Sixth Circuits did in assessing the same legal position that FERC is taking here, shouldn't be left in place without judicial review. And I guess I'd like to start with the judicial review point that some of the questions earlier
touched on. You apparently contend that FERC's orders could potentially harm PG&E in the future, so you're trying to avoid that. Tell me about that.
Yes, Your Honor. I don't think the court needs to inquire into harm to PG&E to apply the usual presumption.
Well, but I asked a question, so you can't tell me my question's irrelevant. Okay. You need to answer it.
There is possible harm to PG&E here, as well as harm to the public. If PG&E were to go into bankruptcy again, which is not an imminent possibility by any means, but it is not impossible, then PG&E could be harmed by these orders in the context of a bankruptcy. But even beyond that, these orders reflect a view of the law that has implications for PG&E outside of bankruptcy. What FERC has said in these orders and what it's argued to this court these orders mean is that despite the market-based system that FERC put into place long ago, where parties freely enter into contracts, and that's how rates are set, each contract has essentially a regulatory shadow that creates ironclad regulatory obligations that persist even if the contract goes away. And that has real implications for how parties enter into these contracts, how the contracts are terminated, and it has possible implications for PG&E going forward. Also, as a matter of the vacature analysis.
So you want FERC out of your life is what you're saying?
Your Honor, we think that these orders haven't been subject to judicial review. We think that if they had been subject to judicial review, they might very well have fallen, looking at the Fifth and Sixth Circuit decisions. And we think there's an interest, not only an interest of PG&E's.
Okay, but let's say we don't know, or we didn't decide the case, but let's just say, but we've been with this case for a while, and we've been looking at all of it. Let's just say, in a backdrop, we think FERC was right. Does that matter in the equation?
I mean, I don't think that is dictating how the normal presumption of vacature plays out. I'm emphasizing it only to put a point on the idea that judicial review of agency orders is extraordinarily important. It runs throughout our law in a variety of areas. And here, I think some of the questions raised this point earlier. There is a reason that FERC wants to keep these orders in place. It's because having the orders in place is something that FERC will use going forward. It will treat these orders as precedent. It will point to them as saying that FERC has had a consistent position, and that will support FERC in the future if there is judicial.
All right, so are you going to tell me if it's vacated, you're not going to claim that the vacature meant that FERC was wrong?
Well, Your Honor, the vacature.
Well,
just...
okay, you can't have it both ways. If
no,
you're
I'm
saying
just kidding, Your Honor, but the vacature just...
you don't want them to stay in place so that they can claim it's precedent. But then if we vacate them, then you're going to argue the second we get out of your sight that FERC lost.
No, Your Honor. The only thing that will happen if the orders are vacated is the thing that always happens when orders are vacated under Munsingware, which is that the order is deprived of preclusive and precedential effect. That's what this court has repeatedly said in vacating orders. And the reason for that is because the orders haven't been able to be tested in the
court. Okay, so FERC can then do this again. And this means nothing. Is that?
FERC can do it again. FERC can issue a new order.
But I want to hear you say that this means nothing to their, they can do it. And then you make the arguments that you've made, but you don't claim, oh, but the court vacated it. And so you should look at that.
Yes, Your Honor. We would not claim that vacature means anything else than that the decision has been wiped off the books to free the parties to litigate the issues in the future. That's what vacature means. That's what the Munsingware Doctrine does. But the fact that FERC can act again in the future to make its views known and can issue a new order or could issue regulations cuts in favor of vacature, because those orders, those regulations, whatever FERC does in the future in this area will be subject to judicial review.
So, counsel, can I get you to clarify? So I hear your argument, and it seems to me that what would happen is if this order wasn't vacated, from our perspective as an appeals court, would be if this came up, the same issue happened again, you know, a decade later, this came up, they would, what PG&E or whoever was in PG&E's, you know, position would argue was, okay, we've got a couple decisions from courts of appeals, the Sixth and Fifth Circuit, the cut again. We have a decision from FERC. I think your briefs would very clearly point out this decision from FERC was just left in place because of Bancorp. It wasn't, this decision from FERC wasn't left in place because of any decision on the merits by the Court of Appeals. And that would be right. And so if I was a judge sitting in that circumstance, I wouldn't give a lot of weight to that decision. I'd probably actually look to the Fifth and Sixth Circuit, since it seems like they, I would. And so from a practical standpoint, obviously FERC and NextEra, they care about having this decision on the books, notwithstanding all of what I just said. I'm trying to figure out why they, what they think they get. You said they get something for it, but what do they get by keeping these decisions on the book?
I agree, Your Honor, that if it came time for judicial review later, a court wouldn't necessarily give a lot of weight to these orders, except to the extent that FERC might order that it had maintained a consistent position over time, which might help it fight off, say, an arbitrary and capriciousness challenge.
I want to hear the rest of your question, but let me on that, they'd still say they'd have a consistent position, because this would just say this decision just went away. Like, you know what I'm saying? This wouldn't be an adverse decision against FERC mooting it. It'd just be have gone away. So I'm not sure I could see if people can always make arguments, just like they can say cert was denied, which means the Supreme Court agrees with me, right? People can say that, but somebody sophisticated would say this wouldn't play into whether it was consistent or not. So I'm not sure that works, but keep going.
Well, I think the decision on the books would be helpful to them in saying that they made a consistent position more than a decision that's been vacated. But even beyond that, it can deform the development of the law and affect parties' behavior in the interim. There may be parties out there, and the public interest is an important part of the Monsignor vacature analysis. It's not just about PG&E. It's also about the public and how other...
I want to hear why, because I don't understand exactly. So I think that must be right, and that's why they must care. So why will it inform public behavior? Because they already have BTS. If this decision went away, why wouldn't that inform public behavior?
But again, that decision is subject to judicial review, and it may fall on judicial review. In fact, just a few weeks ago, there was a rehearing petition filed in that case before FERC, which is a precursor to review in a court. And so that decision may not stand. But if this
The only decision standing simply because it always avoided judicial review. That's a good
exactly.
point.
And there may be parties that are in bankruptcy that don't reject contracts when they otherwise could have under Section 365 of the Bankruptcy Code. There may be parties that don't file for bankruptcy in the first instance because they fear that they won't be able to reject contracts appropriately. Certainly, there won't be prepackaged bankruptcies in this area, which save time and cost and are done quickly. It would become very difficult because parties would fear that they needed to go to FERC and ask for FERC's approval of rejection. So for all of those reasons, there could be real consequences in the world of leaving this order in place, even though it hasn't been subject to judicial review. And again, I think that is why FERC and why the interveners want the order to be left in place, because they think it's going to do something helpful for them in the world if it is, even though future orders, future regulations could be overturned by another court. I'd also like to talk about the fact that PG&E didn't take voluntary action here to move the case so that the Bancorp...
Counsel, I was curious, do you agree with Mr. Shipper's characterization that... the actions that cause the mootness do not have to be related to the pendency of the appeal? Because that's how I read Dilley, to say that those actions have to be related to the pendency of appeal to hold it against that party.
I very much agree with you, Your Honor, that there is a strong statement, not only in Dilley, but also in the Supreme Court's decision in Alvarez and a number of other Monsignor vacature cases, that says essentially if a party is engaged in a larger enterprise and it's sort of going about its business as part of that larger enterprise, in Dilley it was prison officials who were managing a prison but who transferred a prisoner who had brought a claim away. But if that was just part and parcel of the operation of the prison, or here if what PG&E was doing was part and parcel of its obligations as a debtor in possession in this enormous complicated bankruptcy where it had fiduciary obligations to creditors, to employees, to shareholders, in that circumstance, there is not a strategic decision that's being made that's directed at the appeal or directed at the dispute in the appeal to obtain mootness and to try to obtain vacature of a decision that the party doesn't like as a result of mootness. And their courts have been pretty clear that the Bancorp principle doesn't apply. One of the cases that we cited to the court in our supplemental brief is admittedly not a precedential decision of this court. It's an unpublished decision, but we think it's very analogous. It's called Marshak. And that was a decision where the losing party below was a trustee in bankruptcy. That party took the action that mooted his own appeal, which was selling property. What this court said was the Bancorp principle doesn't apply because that was just the party acting in the normal course of his responsibilities as a trustee in bankruptcy, and it wasn't a strategic decision to try to moot out the case. And we think exactly the same thing is true here. As I say, PG&E had a number of obligations as a debtor in possession here to all kinds of parties in this very large and complicated bankruptcy proceeding. As Judge Callahan pointed out earlier, there was also the June 30th deadline under state law that was important for PG&E to meet for a variety of reasons. It helped PG&E, it was really the only reason that PG&E was able to pay the claims in this case, including $25 billion of claims by fire victims. And so PG&E was operating a much larger enterprise here.
Are you telling me you've already spent the $21
billion? Has it all been paid out, Your Honor? No.
it sounds like I'm hearing that you're $4 billion short already.
billions of dollars
have your own money? You have some of your own money?
Billions of dollars have already been paid out to a Fire Victims Trust, and billions of dollars have been paid out into the Go Forward State Wildfire Fund. So there's some money that remains to be paid down the line, but a large amount of money has been paid out, which is part of the reason why the plan became effective. It was substantially consummated. And that's the thing that ended
so
up.
So how much of the $21 billion is left?
I'm not sure I have the exact figures in front of me, Your Honor. I know that I think approximately $5 billion was paid out when the plan became effective into the Fire Victims Trust. And I think approximately an equivalent amount was paid out into this Go Forward Wildfire Fund. But I apologize, Your Honor, I don't have the exact figures in front of me as I sit here today. But nevertheless, it remains the case that PG&E was under tremendous constraints here. And that was true with respect to assumption or rejection of these power agreements as well. PG&E entered the bankruptcy under the cloud of these FERC orders. That was exactly what the counterparties intended when, having received the required state law notice that PG&E was going to file for bankruptcy, they went to FERC, and within a matter of days before PG&E filed for bankruptcy, got FERC to issue these orders. That was meant to cast a pall on PG&E's rejection rights. It was meant to constrain PG&E in its bankruptcy, and that is exactly what it did. And that is not the kind of voluntary action or the voluntary forfeiture that Bancorp talks about, or that cases like Dilley and Alvarez talk about, or that this court talked about in Marsha. So for all of those reasons, I don't think that it's possible to say that PG&E is at blame, at fault for the mootness here. The mootness was something that happened as a result of the bankruptcy unfolding. And one other important thing that I point to in this regard is that PG&E took active steps to attempt to accelerate this court's consideration of these appeals. That was unsuccessful. But we filed a motion in February suggesting further expedition, suggesting treatment of these appeals as urgent under this court's general orders, and explaining the June 30th deadline.
We wouldn't have been as well prepared as we are to hear this appeal if we'd have we've heard that. Do you want to keep the rest of your time, or?
Well, she'll get it. She's down to. But the question is do either does. Just in fairness, because we've taken so much time with the other, if you want to use the balance of your time, I'll still give you 4 minutes, okay, for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Anything else you want to say?
I would very much like to reserve my time for rebuttal if the court doesn't have any other questions. I just add one last thing, which is thank you very much, which is that I think that, first of all, the equities here dictate treating all of these orders the same. We agree that if the court vacates the FERC orders, that the bankruptcy court order should be vacated as well. But what we think should not happen is that the order should receive differential treatment. There are two sides of the same coin and a sort of larger dispute here. And doing that would essentially leave one party victorious, even though the court was unable to reach the merits because of mootness. And to the extent that the court were to think that PG&E were responsible in some way for mootness, then FERC and the interveners bear responsibility as well, because this mootness was coming down the track. It was predictable. That's why PG&E was able to file the motion that it filed before this court in February, and FERC and the interveners didn't take action to protect themselves. That's distinct from the case that Mr. Estes was referring to, because that was a case where mootness occurred, and the question was, should there have been an appeal? Here, the mootness was coming, and PG&E and the interveners could have tried to take some action to avert it. And if I could reserve the remainder of my time.
Thank you. Well, you've used your time, but I'm going to give you 4 minutes so that you have 4 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
All right. So then we go back to Mr. Shepherd, and I think you have 2 minutes.
Hey, Mr. Shepherd, you're mute. Now you're not.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to return to a straightforward application of Bancorp. The rules here are precise and they are clear.
Mr. Shepherd, can I ask you a question related to, I guess, the thing that I found most compelling by your opposing counsel is you got two adverse decisions from courts of appeal, right? Who knows what would have happened if you'd come here? We don't look to the merits, right? We're not going to look at those decisions and say you should lose, therefore you should be mooted. But what does seem sort of significant to me, Mr. Estes talked about how he really likes to have this decision on the books, and I don't know exactly all the reasons, but I believe him, that him and his coalition want to have your decision on the book. But what if we could end up in a weird circumstance where you have, like, say, seven adverse decisions from seven different courts of appeal, except for the Ninth Circuit, right? And you have this one decision that's left in place because we applied Bancorp the way you're saying, and you'd be pointing this decision to see this as precedent, but that'd be really weird. I mean, you'd have seven adverse courts of appeal decision and one FERC decision left standing only because no court ever reviewed it, and you would be able to rely on it, and Mr. Estes would be really happy with that. But that seems to be exactly against the reason why the general Munsingware rule exists. So isn't that a problem for you guys?
Your Honor, no one wants a national rule on this subject more than the commission. We would, of course, like to have proceeded with review of the Sixth Circuit's decision as well as the Fifth Circuit's decision in Merritt. Both of those efforts were frustrated by the following. First, in Merritt, there was no ability to pursue review because the public interest test that was applied by the district court on remand made the decision not to reject those contracts. The dispute went away. On remand and vacature from the Sixth Circuit, which vacated the bankruptcy court's opinion, in that case, you know what happened again? The parties settled. Not only did they settle, but they settled in such a way where they precisely readopted exactly what the filed rate had always been and paid back damages. So no controversy. No one wants to be in front of the Supreme Court more than this commission, more than the Department of Justice, which joined in all of our briefs, including our request for rehearing on bank in the Sixth Circuit. We asked for expedition of this case before PG&E did. We did not oppose the request for further expedition in February. We want a court to review these judgments. We are sure that we're going to get review down the road as the litigation in the Southern District of Texas and the District of Delaware continues. So we want this case to continue. We've been denied our opportunity to defend our orders here, and we've denied our opportunity to challenge the Sixth Circuit's orders as well. But it is absolutely in the commission's interest to press ahead with this. It's also why we did not seek to stay the bankruptcy court's judgment or do anything else to frustrate the orderly processing of this case. To now act like somehow our hands are dirty and that PG&E is some sort of white knight that has done everything it could to advance things is simply It really stretches.
I don't think anyone in California sees PG&E as a white knight, but they do see them as it's a balanced litigation.
I understand. Judge Van Dyke, you wanted to explore a very important question about whether or not the rules in Munsingware and Bancorp apply or should apply differently to administrative orders. So I will read to you straight from the Supreme Court's decision, AL Meckling Barge Lines. This is at 368 U.S. 324. At page 329, simply stated, we think the principle enunciated in Munsingware is at least equally applicable to unreviewed administrative orders, and we adopt this procedure here. That is, of course, also what this court held in Pacific Towboat in the 80s. And this and Pacific Towboat leads us to a whole different problem. In the event that this court decides they wish to vacate the commission's orders over the commission's objection, because we will fiercely fight that wherever we can, then this court also needs to confront the other non-justiciable problems, which have thus far in this discussion been overlooked, although I keep trying to bring us back to that center of gravity. You cannot vacate FERC's orders if you don't have jurisdiction over the orders in the first place, right?
And so, Counsel, I had a question of the Bancorp. In Bancorp, it says we don't apply the automatic rule of vacatur when the party causes mootness, but it's mootness that results from the unilateral action of the party who prevailed below. How did PG&E prevail below before the FERC?
They didn't. They did not prevail below. But
right. So it sounds like Bancorp, that the rule against non-vacatur should not apply since they didn't prevail below.
I think, Your Honor, with respect, I believe that what you just quoted is an upside down version of the rule.
Okay.
I believe that and I could read to you directly from the opinion. If I could,
go for it.
Petitioner's burden as the party seeking relief from the status quo of the appellate judgment to demonstrate not merely equivalent responsibility for mootness, but equitable entitlement to the extraordinary remedy of vacature. Petitioner's voluntary forfeiture of review constitutes failure. So they were the petitioners. They voluntarily forfeited. That means they lost, not that they won. I hope that clears it up, Your Honor. I have several things more to say. My next topic would be Marshak. Marshak, as PG&E's counsel acknowledges, is a non-presidential decision. I think the court was wise not to make it presidential. It is in conflict with presidential decisions, not only of this court, but also of the Supreme Court, and so don't recommend that you follow it. Also, its facts are decidedly uncompelling. That is a Chapter 7 liquidation case. There was no choice on the part of the bankruptcy trustee in that case. His job was to sell the property. Zero choice. And to the extent that one wishes to engage in unilateral or not, discussions about unilateral, non-unilateral behavior, the one thing that I think is absolutely clear.
Let me just ask my panel, do you want to continue to hear this since I'm allowing him to go way over? That's what's important here.
I think I'm fine. I mean, we have your argument on this.
Well, with that then, I'll rest. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Yeah, let's put 5 minutes on for Ms. Goldenberg since I'm going over everywhere. So go ahead.
I appreciate it, Your Honor. Thank you. Just like to clarify what I said before, my colleagues from afar have given me the information about the amount that's been paid out to fire victims. Nothing in the $21 billion wildfire go forward fund has been paid out, although PG&E's paid into that fund. PG&E has paid $25.5 billion to fire victims, but that's from PG&E's own equity and debt. It's not from that fund. But nevertheless, meeting that June 30th deadline was very important in order to enable PG&E to raise the money that let it do that. And so PG&E was operating under a constraint there. I'd like to
so
talk
how
about-
how long before you can next go into bankruptcy?
There's certainly no plan to do that, Your Honor.
Is there a year if you have a plan approved, or can you just go anytime you want to?
I'm not aware of there being a time limitation, Your Honor, but
would it be safe to say if you hadn't gotten the $21 billion, you'd be right back in there?
I think, again, it's not quite as direct as that. It was that it's very important to PG&E going forward to be part of that go-forward wildfire fund. And yes, it is possible that if PG&E hadn't been able to do that, it would not only have had trouble emerging from this bankruptcy, but it would have difficulties going forward. So there was a real constraint there, for sure.
Well, approving the plan now, was any of that approval based on the fact that you were getting $21 billion?
The approval was based on a variety of considerations, and a lot of it certainly was the ability of PG&E to compensate creditors, including fire victims. Yes, absolutely. That was part of the bankruptcy court's analysis in confirming the plan. If I could,
the bankruptcy court maybe not have approved it if you weren't getting $21 billion?
If PG&E hadn't been able, you mean, to participate in the go-forward wildfire fund?
Yeah.
I don't know exactly how that would have turned out, but it certainly is critical to PG&E and to PG&E's operation that PG&E participate in that go-forward wildfire fund. That's the reason that it was so critical, or one of the reasons that it was so critical, to meet that June 30th deadline for confirmation of the plan and approval by the California Public Utilities Commission. Okay. With respect to Marshak, I am unclear on what decision my friend thinks that conflicts with, but Marshak is very much in line with other decisions of this court, precedential decisions, and with Supreme Court decisions. And one of the ways it did that is that it focused on this question of whether there was a strategic decision to moot the case and to give up appeal rights. And it's not only this court that said that, it's the Supreme Court in Alvarez relied on whether a desire to avoid review played any role. That is part and parcel of the Munsingware analysis. And as I said, Marshak is also very consistent with Dilley and with Alvarez in terms of looking at whether the entity is engaged in a larger enterprise when it takes the action that results in mootness. So I think that Marshak is very relevant here, and it's very consistent with precedential decisions. And then the other thing that I would add is that FERC made just a brief reference to a point that it argues in its briefs, that this court needs to address ripeness and collateral attack, the sort of threshold issues, before it gets to the mootness and vacature issues. We don't think that's right. FERC cites a single 1980 case from this court, which has never been subsequently cited for the proposition that relies on a premise that's been exploded by subsequent case law. What the court said there was that it had to address the threshold jurisdictional issue before we ever face the question of mootness. The Supreme Court and this court have subsequently made clear that you can assume a threshold issue, like, for instance, standing, in order to analyze mootness. And in fact, just a few months ago, in an unpublished decision, this court recited that principle. It assumed standing, it found mootness, and it vacated the order below under Munsingwear. And the Supreme Court has done the same thing. And even Bancorp itself says, when talking about why it is that a court can vacate despite not having Article III jurisdiction at the point of mootness, it says vacature is appropriate even though the court doesn't have jurisdiction at that stage and may never, in fact, have had jurisdiction. So we just don't think it's right that the court needs to engage in that threshold analysis. If the court were to do that, we think it's clear that these matters were ripe and that there was no collateral attack. And with respect to ripeness, PG&E suffered an immediate, direct, in-the-moment injury, in fact, as soon as the FERC orders issued, because it had its bargaining power with its counterparties essentially taken away. And that was a real injury. This court's cases say so. And so for all those reasons, I think that the normal presumption of vacature should apply here. There is no Bancorp principle that should apply here. The court should vacate the FERC orders. It should vacate all the orders here. The court should definitely take into account the fact that PG&E, in its bankruptcy, was operating under a number of legal constraints, including the fact that if there hadn't been the fund available that Judge Callahan and I were discussing earlier, then PG&E couldn't have emerged from bankruptcy. It wouldn't have been a viable entity without that fund. That's only one of the constraints that PG&E faced in its bankruptcy that made the actions that it took not voluntary forfeiture within the meaning of this court's case law and the Supreme Court's case law. But unless the court has further questions.
Any questions from my colleagues?
Judge Callahan, I know this would be a little irregular, but I do have one more question for Mr. Shepherd, if you would allow.
Well, it would not be irregular in the sense that I ordered it from the start. So, I promise my colleagues they can ask any questions.
Thank you so much.
Yes, you may do so.
So, Mr. Shepherd, you'll get the last word, but you may not like it. You mentioned this A.L. Meckling barge lines case is sort of to respond to like my concern, which is just an intuitive concern that agencies are different than especially agencies that are acting self-interestedly. And you said, you quoted them to say, we think the principle enunciated in Munsingwear is at least equally applicable to unreviewed administrative orders, and we adopt this procedure here. And I think you were citing that to say we should treat agency orders exactly like. But that's not actually what it's saying here. It's actually saying, the court's saying, we think the principle enunciated in Munsingwear, which is that it should be vacated, the Munsingwear vacature principle, is at least equally applicable, which would imply that it might be more applicable to agency decisions, to unreviewed administrative orders. And so it seems to me that what you cited in A.J. Meckling Barge arguably actually is consistent with the idea that we would approach agency decisions with with more of a thought that we would vacate them, right? And that seems to be what AJ meant. It doesn't seem to be standing for the fact that they're equal. It says at least equally vacatable is what it seems to be saying.
I'm not sure that I understand. I understood your question. So
well, I think he's telling you just like Judge Bumate was said to be upside down, that you were upside down in how you and how you
how dare you say that about my good friend Judge Bumate? No. But
I'm always upside down.
I think what I'm saying is I'm sorry, I'm not real clear, but what I'm saying is it seems to me that A.L. Meckling Barge is saying that we're gonna say that you should at least vacate agency or administrative orders at least as often as you would vacate court orders. But the court left it open that you might vacate them. You might have more of a tendency to vacate them than less. That's what it seems to me A.L. Meckling is saying in context.
I'm not sure that I agree with that reading, and we'd be happy to provide you any supplemental authorities you might wish on the application, whether or not the rule should be any different for appellate actions and on review of agency orders. But I think one place to step back to here is that You'd focus previously on the difference between reviewing a lower court decision within the same branch. I think it would be fair to say that when the court is stepping over to another branch to vacate their actions, that that would be a reason to increase, not decrease, the strength of the test.
I don't know if that's true, because the, you know, the idea is that the courts are non-biased, right? I mean,
well, I would think I would like to have Judge Van Dyke and Judge and Mr. Shepherd cite precedent for what you're each arguing.
That's an invitation to provide a supplemental brief. We will definitely be prepared.
No,
to do that.
I think we can resolve it amidst ourselves. But I want to thank all counsel for being very well prepared and being very helpful. I think I speak on behalf of the entire panel. Thank you. It was a pleasure and very helpful in this process. And I'll give one last. Either of my colleagues have any additional questions?
You judge.
Okay. I think that we are adjourned for the week. Thank you, everyone. And
thank you, counsel.
You'll hear from us.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.
This court for this session stands adjourned.